We'll start in 1 minute. Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so let us begin. Since it's, as I mentioned, we had a long break between the two semesters, many comments were sent to me. I found things of interest, and so for the next few classes, I'll take a few minutes at the beginning of each class and share some of these things. Today, I just have one thing I want to share with you. If you remember, we spoke in the class, it was last semester about, was it the semester before, that Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who after we finished the Rechonim Wasserman, will do the middle years. But in discussing the situation in Egypt, I mentioned that the practice there was in the shul, and I believe at least it used to still be this exact same practice in Brooklyn. You could check it out at Ava V'Achva, that people make a pledge on Shabbos, and a non-Jew records it. He stays in another room and he records it, so after Shabbos they can collect the money. Well, in Mar Cheshvan issue of the Torah Journal Or Torah, which comes out of B'nai Brak, there's a piece in here from Rabbi Mazuz, and he relates to that because there's a very, very strange question that came up in Rabbi, if you know the name Rabbi Zilberstein, Yitzhak Zilberstein. He's full of strange questions, and most of them I can't believe are authentic questions. I'm sure he makes them up, because some of the questions are just so crazy that it's unimaginable that they could be authentic questions. We have this already, the Trumas Edeshen. He has the two sections there. The questions are made up. And there's nothing wrong with making up strange questions for halachic principles. But the question that Rabbi Zilberstein dealt with is he had an Orthodox synagogue in which a rich person came in, was given an aliyah. I'm reading the question for you now. And not only did he got the aliyah, and he donated a lot of money. And after Shabbos, there was an argument between this rich person and the gabbai. The rich person says, I pledged $200. And the gabbai says, you pledged $2,000. And the gabbai was able to prove his case. Why? Because he brought out a tape. Inside the bima, there's a tape recorder there. And he played for him the brachas that he made on Shabbos, and also the amount that they called out, $2,000. What it says in here was that they did this every Shabbos so that the rich people, when they made the pledge, they couldn't later claim otherwise. So I don't believe that there's any Orthodox shul in America that has a tape recorder playing there. But so that's the question he's asked. So that's the beginning of the question. And then the question continues that the rich person was so shocked that there's chil Shabbos in the middle of an Orthodox shul. He said that, now I'm not going to pay you anything. Because any shul, Lebeit Knesset Kazeh, Shemakliting Bo B'Shabbat, such a shul that, a so-called Orthodox shul that tapes me on Shabbos, that wasn't the sort of shul that I pledged to. I pledged to a real shul, not a phony shul that has tape recorders hidden. So the question came to Israel, is this appropriate or not? And they took it to Rav Chaim Kanievsky. And Rav Chaim Kanievsky says that the rich person doesn't have to pay a penny, because he never intended, when he donated the money, he never intended to give it to a shul like this, that's Bechal Shabbos. But in order that the shul not lose out on the money, The gabbai himself has to give the $2,000 out of his own pockets. And that's what Rabbi Zilberstein reports in the name of Chaim Kanievsky. So Rav Mazuz says, I mean, this story is shocking on its face, as Rav Mazuz says. So if the gabbai sinned, how did the synagogue sin? Okay, so if it's the gabbai who put in the tape recorder, that's the case, that it was the gabbai who did that. So Rav Mazuz says, how did the synagogue sin? Does this make the synagogue like a reformed temple? Not such a good question, because maybe you could say it was the synagogue itself who knew about it. But he goes on and talks about how, this doesn't make sense, because obviously the gabbai thought this was permissible. So if the gabbai thought this was permissible, how can you take away from the money from the shul? And then he mentions, look at what Ravadi Yosef records, that in Egypt, the practice was that a non-Jew would be in the next door room. And when they announced who pledged, the non-Jew would write it down. And what does Rav Mazuz say? Tape hamufal me'erev Shabbat kiltfei migoy. That there's no question, according to Rav Mazuz, that it's a more of a halachic problem to have a non-Jew writing down every pledge than if a tape's already running and it's recording anyway. The fact that you speak doesn't change anything one way or the other. It's the same. You're not doing anything. The tape is recording whether you speak, whether you don't speak. It's recording the whole time, and therefore Rav Mazuz says that he can't understand such a ruling that even if the gabbai did wrong, he now has to pay the $2,000. Since when is that a punishment for making a mistake like that? So that's, I think, is interesting. The other thing I want to mention, I'll only mention if the person who sent it to me is on with us now. He's not on with us now, so I'm not going to mention it. I'll mention it next time. So let me begin then by pointing out something that one of our listeners did mention the last class, and this now we're back to where we should be. Moshe from Lakewood, who's on with us right now. I mentioned, if you recall, that Rabbi Ochanan says, and this is a theme you find elsewhere as well, and it's a common theme. You find this, people say these things all the time, that what caused all this anti-Semitism that he relates to? Jews trying to be like the non-Jews, trying to speak their language, dress like them, all these things, rather than stopping the anti-Semitism, that actually increased the anti-Semitism. And now that's a theme you often find. He called my attention to a Midrash Rabbah in Parshas Matos, which actually states the opposite, which I was unaware of this Midrash Rabbah. It has Moshe speaking. He says to God, "Im haynu arelim, if we were uncircumcised, ovdei kochavim, or kofrei mitzvot, if we were complete heretics, lo hayu sonin otanu, ve'enan rodfin acharenu. They wouldn't, the non-Jews wouldn't care about us. They wouldn't hate us. It's only bishvil Torah mitzvot shenatatalanu. It's only because of the Torah you gave us. That's why they hate us so much." So you have here a midrash which says the exact opposite of this idea. Now, which is empirically correct? It's a good question. I think in the day, this might be a question of a different time. In the days of, you didn't have notions of anti-Semitism, racial anti-Semitism of the sort. And even religious anti-Semitism in the days of the Second Temple and even the centuries afterwards. If a Jew wanted to, you didn't have racism. The whole notion of racism didn't exist against other races because he didn't have a concept of race. If a Jew stopped practicing his practices and wanted to become Greek, Hellenize himself, no one would relate to him as a Jew. But in later years, and of course, once we get into real, scientific quote anti-Semitism, then it really has nothing to do with the religion you practice. It has to do with where you are. Now, even in Spain, those who want to come on our Spain trip this summer, we'll talk a lot about this, the great dispute over the Marranos, because Benicio Netanyahu and some others have argued that you actually have real racial anti-Semitism in Spain, so much so that that's the reason for the Inquisition, that the people who converted to Christianity, they still were not accepted. And the Inquisition was a way of getting rid of these Jews, even though they were technically not Jews anymore because they had converted. Let us pick up. We were what we're going to talk about right now. I'll get to all the questions towards the end. What we'll talk about right now is something we dealt with last semester, but we have to revisit it because now we're focusing on Rav Hanan Wasserman. And that is Avodah Ivrit. And then we're going to get into the amazing issue of should Agudas Yisrael support the creation of a Jewish state in the land of Israel? And from the 1937 convention in Marienbad. We'll get to that in a couple minutes. But let's go back to Avodah Ivrit, which is the idea that when in Palestine, you should only hire Jewish workers for a few reasons. First, the most fundamental reason is because you want to give the money to Jews. And, there were concerns about it wasn't safe. You had riots then, just like today, you have a situation in Israel. The problem was, though, that it was cheaper to hire Arabs. So could you be required halachically to hire Jews? So that's the issue. And we have to look at it because it was in this matter of Avodah Ivrit that Rabbi Chanan Wasserman showed that he was not afraid to insert himself into a dispute taking place in Eretz Yisrael. Why would a rabbi in Europe interfere and give his opinion on what's going on in Israel? Israel has plenty of great rabbis, but that's exactly what happened. Now, the year was 1934, and the dispute was, is it permissible, halachically we're talking, for Jews to hire Arabs if the Arabs are cheaper? And the Metzius is that if the Jews who did do that, the Histadrut would picket them and make a big, scene. Because they hired Arabs, and it even could get worse. I mean, your windows could be broken. There was an element of coercion involved in that they were trying to pressure Jews to only hire Jews, and that was in addition to the idea that every Jew was made to feel that you have to support Jews. The Histadrut, although it's majority secular, non-observant, there were religious members of Histadrut, such as Poalei Mizrahi. And the Workers' Party of Mizrahi, of Rhodes Zionist, and they supported Avodah Ivrit, that you have to hire Jews. And that was the issue. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, as I mentioned, it's not clear why he thought he had to speak out on this. We saw last semester, and I'll look at it again in a few minutes, that both Reuven Katz in Petah Tikva and Chaim Moshe Grudzinski also couldn't understand why, and they were annoyed that Rabbi Chanan did speak out, interfere in this matter. I mean, as I said, it's strange because if this is a religious issue, let the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael handle it. Why should the Chutz La'aretz rabbi get involved? Rabbi Chanan had an answer for this. In response to this claim that he should not involve himself in it, and I'll talk in detail about his position in a second, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman said that precisely those in Israel are apt to be influenced by their surroundings instead of seeing the matter in objective fashion. It's almost it's a exact opposite of what you would think. The people in Israel, the rabbis in Israel, were saying that only the rabbis in Israel are able to discuss this matter because they are living in Israel. They're on the spot. They can see what's happening there. The rabbis in Chutz La'aretz don't understand what's going on, the situation here. And Rabbi Chanan said, on the contrary, it's only us in Chutz La'aretz who can look at it objectively. We're not influenced by the forces like the Histadrut and other things. So, and Rabbi Chanan's point, his argument's going to be, just to anticipate what we'll say in a minute, that there is no reason whatsoever to hire Jews if you can hire Arabs who are cheaper. So he's not only interfering in an internal Israel dispute, he's giving a position which is opposed by the majority of Jews of all stripes in the land of Israel. This matter turns out Imre Schaefer, which is maybe you can see it here. It's pieces on Torah and recorded conversations with Rav Avram Shapiro, the former chief rabbi, Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz HaRav. And on page 272, he begins a discussion with some other matters, and then he gets to Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, and it's pointed out to him that in the Kovetz Ma'amarim, the new edition of the Kovetz Ma'amarim of Rabbi Chanan, it has the negative points about Rav Kook that we spoke about last week. And what does Rav Shapiro say? That Rav Shapiro says that this Sefer, Kovetz Ma'amarim, when he reprinted this material against Rav Kook, is a pgiyah b'chvodosh Rabbi Chanan, is a it injures Rabbi Chanan. Because we can see clearly that Rabbi Chanan didn't know what he was talking about in this matter. As we saw last week, He goes into this great attack, referring to Rav Kook as a Rasha for supporting the Keren HaYesod, when the fact is that Rav Kook never supported the Keren HaYesod. He only supported the Keren Kayemet. So Rav Ochanan, so Rav Avram Shapiro says that this never should have been put in there, and rather than giving Rav Chana Wasserman honor, it takes away from his honor. And what does Rav Shapiro say? He says Rav Ochanan was able to err in this matter precisely because why? He was in Chutz Aretz, v'lo yada ma shekoreh ba'aretz. Despite the fact that Rav Ochanan says he sees it more clear because he's in Chutz Aretz, here we have a perfect example of Avraham says that he didn't see it clear, he didn't even have the basic facts. And then it says, Rav Avram says, Ukfar nidpas michtavo shel Rav Chaim Ozer Rabbi Yochanan, and the letter has already been printed by Rav Chaim Ozer to Rabbi Yochanan, shebohu doresh mimenu shlo yitarev b'inyanei Eretz Yisrael, that he should not involve himself in affairs of the land of Israel. So this letter has nothing to do with Rav Kook. This letter of Rav Chaim Ozer has to do with Avodah Ivrit. Because what did Rav Yochanan say? He published an open letter against what the Histadrut was doing, that is, the pressure upon people to hire only Jews. He said that according to Halakha, an owner, it's his store, he could hire whoever he wants to hire. And that's true. There's no question that that's true. However, we're not speaking about Poland here, where he lived. And we're not speaking about a private matter between an employer and an employee. This matter of Avodah Ivrit has to be seen in the context of a battle over the future of the land of Israel. Can Jews from Chutz Aretz go on Aliyah? They can't go on Aliyah if they can't have jobs. They can't, you can't set up businesses if you're not, if you see, if you set up businesses, you're not going to support Jews. You're going to destroy the economy of the Jewish section. I mean, this is not an individual issue. This is a national issue, as we'll see soon. Furthermore, we know that rabbis have the right to make takanot, to make ordinances, and say they have the halachic right to say you have to hire Jews. I mean, look, if the Jews is asking, double salary, that's one thing. But rabbis have the authority on money matters. They can say if it's only 10% or 50%, you have to hire the Jew. I mention this only to show that it's not a simple halachic matter, and it can't easily be settled by Rabbi Chanan saying, well, that this is a simple halachic matter, that any owner has the right to hire whoever he wants, because it wasn't simple at all, as we saw last semester and we'll see again. Now, another issue motivating Rabbi Chanan was that he was opposed to the connection of the non-Orthodox to the non of the Orthodox to the non-Orthodox dominated socialist Histadrut. I'll get to your point about protectionism and this towards the end. I'll return to all the questions. I mean, we dealt with the rabbinic understandings of economics in a previous class when I went through of Henkin's defense of rent control, which sounds very nice but would destroy housing stocks. But we'll get back to that. Another issue motivating Rabbi Ochanan's position was that he did not think that the Orthodox should have anything to do with the Histadrut. That to him was a very worrying development. Now he published this letter, an open letter, in Poland and in Jerusalem, and who was it directed to? It wasn't directed to the Mizrahi, Poland Mizrahi. They don't listen to Rabbi Ochanan, who's an Agudist. It was directed to an organization of Agudists who were known as Poalei Agudas Yisrael. There was a whole group of workers, the proletariat, who were adherents of Agudas Yisrael, and they had an organization called Poalei Agudas Yisrael, in which they looked towards the great rabbis of Agudas Yisrael, but they had their own special interests, and they opened. You have kibbutzim that are to this day considered Poalei Agudas Yisrael, though it doesn't really exist anymore. For example, Kibbutz Chafetz Chaim is a Poalei Agudas Yisrael. I think Shalvim is Poalei Agudas Yisrael. So he sent this letter, he directed it to Poalei Agudas Yisrael, and he told them that although an owner does have to favor a Jew, that is, if you have a Jew and a non-Jew, you have to favor the Jew, this is not the case if the salary of the Jew will be significantly higher. So the question is, what's significantly higher? Everyone would agree that if it's significantly higher, you don't have to hire a Jew. The question is, what is the definition of significantly? And the rabbis in Israel who supported Avodah Ivrit didn't see the salaries as significantly high. I don't know the fact, in fact, how much higher Jews were, if it was a third more or whatever it is. He also tells Rabbi Chanan also tells Poalei Agudas Yisrael not to act like non-Orthodox worker unions. That is, don't act like a union. Paul Agudas Yisrael, as I mentioned, always looked towards the great rabbis of Agudas Yisrael. And they had rabbis who they asked. They responded. I don't know what Rabbi Chanan thought of this response. He might have thought it was chutzpahdik, but they responded to Rabbi Chanan that, Rabbi Chanan, with all due respect, you don't understand the situation here in Eretz Yisrael. And before sending us this letter, which was not requested, they didn't request this letter, they didn't request guidance from him. He just sent them the letter. They said, Rabbi Chanan, they said it with kavod, but they said, you should have come to Eretz Yisrael and actually investigate the situation. I mean, I'm assuming people could say that today, even with the stress on Das Torah. Well, actually, I know they would, because when Rabbi Steinman was in America, and he is the final address for Das Torah, he gave a speech at before all these mechanchim, educators, and said that educators should not, rebbes should not play ball with the kids, because then the kids won't have any respect for the rebbe if the rebbe's playing basketball with them. And later they asked Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, and he said to ignore what Rav Steinman said, because Rav Steinman doesn't understand what it means to be a Rebbe in America. On the contrary, if you play ball with the kids, that gives you more of a connection to them, and you'll have an influence. But I guess Rabbi Kamenetsky could say that. I don't know if an average person could say it, but and get away with it in Agudas circles. That is, say it publicly. But here they did say publicly, Paul Agudas Yisrael, these are just laborers, and they said that, we're not accepting what you said, Rabbi Chanan, because you don't know the Mitzvot here. And they said to him that the hiring of Jewish workers is essential, and the whole economic future of the Yishuv, of settlement in the land of Israel, depends on Avodah Ivrit. This isn't an option. This isn't individual. We need to do what we can to strongly encourage, i.e., force, if, for lack of a better word, people to hire Jewish workers. This strong response by the Pole Agudas Yisrael did not affect Rabbi Chanan in the least. And he responded again. Well, he responded. The first time it was an open letter, and now it's a response telling Pole Agudas Yisrael why they're wrong. And you know what's going to happen here. They're going to turn to the other rabbis. But, at first they wrote to him. Rabbi Chanan adds on, repeats what he said before. You can find all this in the collected writings of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. He repeats what he says before, and then he adds and says, it is forbidden, asur, for Poel Agudas Yisrael to join the Histadrut. The Poel Agudas Yisrael, the workers, I mean, the only way to really advance your cause was to be a member of the union, the Histadrut, which was very powerful in those days. And there are many jobs you could not get if you were not in the Histadrut. It was an extremely powerful organization in those years. And that was their position. And Rabbi Chanan said that it is still forbidden and you have to trust in God. Rabbi Chanan acknowledges in his letter that some Orthodox individuals may not be able to withstand this test. They need to get a job, and they can't get a job unless they're a member of the Histadrut. So he says, well, they can do, let them do it. I mean, they're wrong to do it, but if they're going to do it, they'll do it as individuals. But to have Poalei Agudas Yisrael, which is a section of Agudas Yisrael, it was an official section of Agudas Yisrael until the early 1950s, when they broke with Agudas Yisrael. So Rabbi Chanan says you can't have Poalei Agudas Yisrael be a part of the Histadrut, because how can you have a part of Agudas Yisrael, this Orthodox organization, member being a member of a non-Orthodox organization? Even though the Histadrut is not a religious organization, it was dominated by the non-Orthodox. Poalei Agudas Yisrael ignores what Rabbi Chanan says, and it joins the Histadrut. Now, I mentioned already that Poalei Agudas Yisrael had their own rabbis, and Rabbi Chanan was never one of their rabbis. Who were their rabbis? One of their rabbis, after he came to Eretz Yisrael in 1933, was the Chazon Ish. The Poalei Agudas Yisrael people would send their questions to Rabbi Chaim Moshe Grodzinski, and he would answer them. And then when the Chazon Ish came to Israel, to Eretz Yisrael, the Rav Chaim Ozer told them, ask your questions of the Chazon Ish. And a great relationship developed between the Chazon Ish and the Poalei Agudas Yisrael. And the Chazon Ish loved them. He visited their kibbutzim, or at least one of their kibbutzim. He, Kamen Kahana, who was the leader of the Poalei Agudah, Rabbi Kamen Kahana from the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, by the way, who becomes at Kibbutz Chafetz Chaim, he's at rabbi there. He becomes very close to the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish, he loved the simple Jews. the farmers, I mean, the people who were making a living. You didn't have a community today like you have of yeshiva students learning all day. So if you ask the Chazon Ish, what's the best part of the Torah world? The best part of the Torah world is these Jews, pious Jews, who work in the fields till, let's say, 3 in the afternoon, and then do the rest, and then spend the rest of the time learning. So he had a wonderful relationship with them, and the Chazon Ish supported Avodah Ivrit, and this applied even if the worker was not religious, as we'll see. So Paul Agudas Yisrael, had they been told by the Chazon Ish not to go to the Histadrut, had they told by the Chazon Ish, not to press this issue of Avodah Ivrit, they would have listened to the Chazon Ish. But he disagreed with Rav Chanan. We'll see the Chazon Ish disagrees with a number of things Rav Chanan says. And I'm not going to say it's because one was in Eretz Yisrael, one was not. As we'll see today, Rav Chanan had a much more extreme view on all these matters. When the Chazon Ish stated that, when he said to Paul Agudas Yisrael that Avodah Ivrit applies even if the Jew is not religious, he was making this point in opposition to Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, because Rabbi Chanan Wasserman said in his not the first letter, in the second letter, I believe, or maybe the first letter, about Avodah Ivrit, Rabbi Chanan says, and what I'm going to tell you now is the sort of thing that we spoke a little bit about last week, that, for example, is covered up today. Throughout these courses, I've often told you things that will appear in the Hebrew versions of works. They won't appear in the Art Scroll translation, because today people don't understand this. It's hard to make, if even for Haredim to understand it, it's hard to explain it to them. It goes against the value that's advocated sincerely, and value that's spoken about. And they mean it sincerely, that we care about all Jews equally. Obviously, we're Torah Jews, but we care about all Jews equally. We don't make distinctions, between Jews. We only fight about religious issues. Well, that hasn't always been the case. And to present a different position would break, the uniformity of what today is the Aguda, I guess, propaganda, not in a bad word way, but propaganda can be a good thing too. But the Aguda message that we don't distinguish between Jews. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman states that when you're dealing with a non-observant Jew, there is no reason to favor him, even if his salary is only a little more than an Arab. That is, a non-Shomer Shabbos, a non-religious Jew, is not your brother, and therefore, forget Avodah Ivrit when it's a significantly higher salary. Rav Chanan agreed that if it's only a little bit higher, you have to hire a Jew. But if he's not a religious Jew, you have no responsibility to him, and you don't need to hire them. Don't need to hire him. And it was this point that the Chazon Ish opposed, and said that's not true, and that we favor non-observant Jews over non-Jews. Now, Rabbi Chanan actually explains in his second letter that if the or again, this is my memory, maybe it's the first letter, but he says if the salary, I said before, I didn't remember, I don't know the figures, I forgot, I have the figures written down. He said that anything under 20% more, then you have to hire the Jew. That is, if the Jew is 20%, less than 20%, you hire the Jew. But if the Jew is more than 20%, you're an Arab, no problem. But that only applies to religious workers. So here we see Rabbi Chanan Wasserman explicitly stating you have no achrayut, achrayus, for the non-observant. This is the sort of comment today you'd find Satmar make, you'd find the Eda Charedis make. I mean, the Eda Charedis, if you've been following the news, is engaged in a campaign right now. You had it in the magazine Mishpacha, but that was one Haredi author, and the whole Haredi society was outraged by this, and you didn't hear it again. But in the Eda Haredi today is engaged in a campaign. This has been covered in all the papers to explain to the Arab population. They're raising money to put out ads in Arab newspapers that don't attack us because we don't go on the Temple Mount, and that as if this whole thing going has some anything to do with the Temple Mount. And from their perspective, that makes perfect sense. You're going to see a letter in the next Sfarim blog that I come out probably next week from a figure in during World War II. To the don't the Nazis are going to be he's worried the Nazis are going to be invading the land of Israel, and he's writing, don't attack us. us old yeshuv people, because we're not involved in politics and we have no problems with you. So this is an old theme by the extremists, and but you don't expect this from an agudist. But as I said, Rabbi Hanan had views that are not mainstream agudist then or today, but we can't cover it up. We need to understand it. And it's complicated because I don't know how to square this with this. I don't know how to square what Rabbi Hanan says in his open letters dealing with Avodah Ivrit, which in, with another letter in which he says that the non-religious in the masses, you know, the non-religious masses, they are different from the Zionist leaders. The masses follow blindly and therefore have to be regarded as unwitting sinners. That is, that they don't know any better. According to that letter of Rabbi Chanan, of course you have to treat a non-religious Jew, better than an Arab. You have to treat him like a religious Jew because he doesn't know any better. And yet, Rabbi Chanan directly contradicts that point in his letters dealing with Avodah Ivrit. So I don't know. I don't know how to square that. It seems like it's a contradiction. Now, if you read the biography of the Chazon Ish, Pe'er HaDor, there's been a number of biographies of Chazon Ish. The first one, we are told that he strongly disagreed with this point of Rabbi Hanan Wasserman about that you have no responsibility for the non-observant. He saw this, the Chazon Ish saw Avodah Ivrit as a type of tzedakah. And we know that Beis Din can actually force you to give tzedakah. Chazon Ish pointed out that we don't find that you discriminate between poor Jews when it comes to tzedakah. You don't only give to someone wearing a yarmulke. You give to everyone. If you think of it for a minute, if everyone were to adopt Rabbi Chanan's position, then the whole argument which has been made that the Zionists only favored the Zionists when they rescued people would fall apart, because obviously, why should I for the Zionists? The whole basis of the accusation is that we're all Jews and we have to, that when it comes to saving lives, etc., we have to be treated equally. But and the Chazon Ish strongly disagreed with Rabbi Chanan in this. But it wasn't just the Chazon Ish. Let me read you from what Rabbi Chaim Moshe Gruzinski says. And there are a number of letters. Beginning on page 276, the first letter you have here is a letter to Reuven Katz, Chief Rabbi of Petah Tikva. We dealt with him last semester. And Reuven had written to him complaining that Rabbi Chanan Wasserman had sent this letter. And Rabbi Chanan Wasserman was not an insignificant person, he was an important Agudist leader. And he had sent this letter, and Reuven doesn't know what to make of this, and he's annoyed with it. And, this was printed in the newspapers, it was printed, which were placed all over the synagogues, that is, people who, in Chutz La'aretz and in Israel. And Reuven writes to Reb Chaim Moser, and Reb Chaim Moser says, "You're writing to me about this, about these matters that are in the newspaper and hung up in shuls, and you are correctly complaining about this." Et pelegamani, he says, "I'm also shocked. What did he see? Lefarsem, where did he get the idea to publicize his private opinion without consulting? And I didn't even know about this." And then he says, "Gam hifizal amida." Rav Chaim Moser says that Rabbi Chanan and his brother-in-law exaggerated here. Why? Listen to these words: "Ein inyanei hayishuv b'artzeinu hakdosha domim inyanim pratim begolah mikama tamim v'nimukim." He says that when dealing with the land of Israel, you're dealing with a whole population. It's not the same thing as inyanim pratiim, of private matters. That is, one in Poland, in Baranovich, an individual shopkeeper hiring a non-Jew versus a Jew. There are national issues at stake in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore you can't just take, oh, the halacha is that if it's if it's too much, you don't hire a Jew. There's very important issues and concern there. And then he says, and especially in inyan hagadol v'nichbad kazeh, in such a complicated and important matter, ef merachok, you can't make such a decision in chutz aretz without seeing up close. Varakal beitin chashuv bimkomam. You can only have a Beis Din on the spot. Asher lo aman Yisrael, bar tzedakah kedusha. He says, Israel has many great rabbis. They're the ones who can have to make this decision. So we see Rabbi Chaim Moser also disagrees strongly. The next letter here is, I don't know, if Reuven Katz wrote to him a second time, or this, it says it's Hosafas Svarim. He added on to his original letter. And he says further, he says, Hayali Egmas Nefesh. He says it caused me pain, it troubled him. And I wrote to Rav Chaim Moser, why did you do this without discussing it with me? And especially since Rav Chaim Moser says that the Moetzes Gedolei Torah had decided that this is something that's not for us to rule on. Because who are we? We're in Chutz Laaretz. We don't know the situation. It should be given to a Beis Din in Eretz Yisrael. And then he goes on with certain halachic issues. And then on page 278, you have the letter to Poaleh Agudas Yisrael. Poaleh Agudas Yisrael also wrote to Rav Chaim Moser complaining that they're being told to do something by Rabbi Chana West. I'm sure it's a very respectful letter, but the upshot was going to be that he's trying to bully us into adopting a certain position by me. It wasn't a private letter, it was a public letter, and as I said, it was plastered all over, designed to force them, to embarrass them almost, into abandoning this association with the Histadrut and Avodah Ivrit. And again, Reb Chaim Moser says to them, I didn't know about this beforehand, I was quite surprised by this. And he says the same thing. You can this such a decision cannot be made without seeing up close. And the only answer is to turn to the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael. And he says to them, I wish you success in your works, avodat hayishuv, working. And Rav Chaim Moser also disagrees. There was another issue that Rav Ochanan would have a great disagreement with. And that was the matter. Oh, before I even get to that, I forgot to, one more thing I forgot to mention, because it's sitting here, right here for me. Remember, I mentioned last class. I couldn't remember if Rabbi Shimon Schwab, when he asked all the Gedolim the question about secular studies, I know what the Ger Rebbe said, that he didn't want to speak bad against Torim Derech Eretz because Rav Hirsch is such a great tzaddik. I wasn't sure if Schwab asked him, and it turns out he did. I checked the sources here. I'm holding a book called Three Generations, The Influence of Samson Raphael Hirsch on Jewish Life and Thought by Diane Grunfeld, and he records the conversation, he records from Rabbi Schwab, who told him personally that the Ger Rebbe said to him that it's definitely forbidden to study secular studies, but I will never say anything against the Tzaddik of Frankfurt, Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, because he is a living Musar Sefer. Er is gevein a lebedik Musar Sefer. So if anyone wants to see that, you can get further information from Rabbi Grunfeld's work. Okay, let's get that to the next issue, the Vaad HaLeumi. When the British took over Palestine, they wanted to set up a whole a community for Jews. It had the a rep which would be ruled by Jewish leaders, basically like an autonomous sort of community, and Jews would belong to it, and that would be the community that would deal with the British government. They did the same thing with the Arabs, and it was known as the Vaad HaLeumi. The problem again was if you're a an Austrian type of person, if you're a Hirschian, you're gonna have a problem probably. Because the community is going to comprise both Orthodox and non-Orthodox, and majority Orthodox, non-Orthodox. So, for example, the leadership is going to be people like Ben Gurion and Moshe Sharet and Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, and you'll have a couple Orthodox Jews like Rabbi Maimon and Meir Bar Ilan, but it's going to be dominated by the non-Orthodox and the tax money that Jews pay to the British government, which will then, portions of it will then. Be sent back to the Vaad HaLeumi, which will distribute it to fund schools. Irreligiosity is being funded by this organization, so can you be a part of it? And Rabbi Chanan will make the argument that it's forbidden for an Orthodox Jew to be a member of this kehila, this Vaad HaLeumi. Now the problem, and most Jews, almost all Jews, were members of the Vaad HaLeumi. You had a small group, the Edah Haredit, which still exists to this day, who refused to be part of it, but I mean, most Jews were a part of it, including almost all Jews. I'm talking about all Orthodox Jews. All the Agudistin who came from Poland and Lithuania to the land of Israel, were members of the Vadholomi. That is, they were part of this larger community, and it didn't bother them in the slightest. And why should it bother them? And this was the problem Elkanah's going to have. Every community in Poland and in Lithuania was comprised of Orthodox and non-Orthodox. Every community in Poland and Lithuania had elections. And who was ran for the elections? All sorts of people. In every community board, you had the Agudists, you had the Aguda, you had Mizrahi, you had the Bundes. They all sat together. You only had separatism in Germany and in Hungary. But most Jews lived in Poland and Lithuania. And they all were in one community. In Russia is, of course, also and the same thing. And in Latvia, all these places, one community. So how can you ban the Vadholmi? Furthermore, there were great rabbis who supported being part of the Vadholmi. I will read you soon what Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer writes to Rabbi Chanan. Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer, who we're going to get to after we do the Rabbi Chanan, then we're going to do Rabbi Avadia Yosef. Then, in response to a request, I'm going to do Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer. In 1925, Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer comes to Eretz Yisrael, and like everyone else, he joins the Vat HaOlmi. And he writes to Rabbi Chanan. He didn't understand why Rabbi Chanan was making such a big deal. He was sending out letters, all this sort of thing. Can't be part of the Vat HaOlmi. Yes, non-religious Jews controlled it, but there is a possibility for religious Jews to have an impact. For example, Rav Isser Zalman said that if we're part of the general community, community events have kosher, are kosher. You have an old age home, let's say, an old age home funded by the Vat HaOlmi. If there's no Orthodox Jews in the Vat HaOlmi, then it's not going to be kosher. But if the Orthodox Jews are members of the community, then of course it'll be kosher. When the Orthodox Jews are in the Vat HaOlmi, well, then the people want to get married. They go to a Jew. If the Jews were going to leave at the Vat HaOlmi, then they wouldn't be one community. Say, well, go to the British. What do we need rabbis for? We can have a secular marriage. We can have all this stuff. So Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer said the fact that the Orthodox are involved allows them bad. The Orthodox Jews had their schools, the non-Orthodox had their schools, and the cemeteries were run by the Orthodox. Other things were run by the Orthodox, and the irreligious, they were the majority, but as long as they're not oppressing the Orthodox, in other words, it had no impact. But Rabbi Chanan said even to be a part of that community was forbidden. And we'll see soon how he responds to Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer's claim that you yourself and everyone else in Poland is a member of a community with the irreligious. He has an answer to that. Let me read you now, or summarize for you, what it says in the Art Scroll book, Rebbe Ochanan, which I'm just, because it's in English, it's easier. It's a translation of Sorosky's two-volume biography of Rebbe Ochanan. Let me begin by saying Rebbe Ochanan wasn't moved at all by what Rav Isser Zalman said to him. I mean, for Rebbe Ochanan, he's explicit that you cannot be together, you cannot join together with a heretic, even for a mitzvah. And that we'll see is the difference between Eretz Israel and Poland. In the land of Israel, you had to declare that I'm a member of the Vat HaOlmi. In Poland, in Lithuania, by definition, when you're born a Jew, you're a member of the Jewish community. You can get out of it by saying I'm not Jewish, but you're already a part of it. But the Vat HaOlmi is that you actually had to declare, yes, I am Jewish, and that means I'm a member of the Vat HaOlmi, or I am Jewish, and I don't want to be part of the Vat HaOlmi. I want to be the Eda Charedi. So that's why Rabbi Chanan is going to say in Israel, you are joining with the heretics, and that makes a difference. But as we'll see, not only Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, the Chazon Ish didn't see this as an issue at all. But let me read you part of what it says here in the biography, which is a summary, just because it's easier to, well, or I'll summarize part. Rabbi Isser's letter, 281 to Zalman Meltzer's letter to Rabbi Ochanan. Actually, no, it's not. Sorry, it's the summary of, it's the response of Rabbi Ochanan to Rabbi Isser Zalman. Everything I told you about Rabbi Isser Zalman just said. So it says, Rabbi Isser Zalman spoke at length about kashrus and how by having the Orthodox Jews involved in the Vav Homi, they're able to improve kashrus, etc. And Rabbi Ochanan replies that the most important thing, it's not kashrus, it's Jewish education. The Vav Homi administers schools in which tens of thousands of children are educated in heresy, etc., etc. Vav is for the sake of heaven. You can rescue whatever is possible because if you're not involved in the Vav Homi, you can't even try to bring Judaism to them. Rav Zalman, Rav Hanan says to him that that is still forbidden because you cannot do a sin for the sake of heaven. He says that Rav Hanan says that there is a notion of Avera Lishma, but he quotes Rav Chaim of Volozhin that it doesn't apply anymore today, and therefore don't tell me, Rav Zalman, that by you being a part of the Vav Homi, you places bring Torah. You're not allowed to be in, do a sin for what you think is going to help people. And being part of the Vav Homi is allying yourself with wicked sinners. And then he says, well, what about the fact that there were rabbis who were pious, who were part of the Vav Homi? This actually, Artscroll adds this in brackets, actually, Sorosky adds it, because this is not part of his letter to Rav Zalman, but this is something else that he was challenged at. How could Rabbi Ochanan say that you can't be the Vav Homi? Look at all the great Rabbanim who were in the Vav Homi. And what did Rabbi Ochanan say? He gave an example of two shochtim, each of whom were equally learned and devout, but there was a major difference between them. One had a delicate sense of touch and could detect the hardly noticeable nicks in the slaughtering knife that render slaughter invalid. The other could not detect the nicks. Despite his sincerity and scholarship, he lacks an essential qualification to be entrusted with kosher slaughter. So it is in areas of public policy. Some great Torah leaders have proven themselves sensitive to spiritual nicks that endanger the national survival, while others have not, despite their greatness in other areas. So what Rabbi Chanan was saying is that you have these great rabbis, such as Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, and they're pious and they're Talmid Chachamim, but they're like the Shochet who knows all the halachas and is pious but can't detect the nicks. He's saying that people like Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, they have a blind spot and they don't see that what they're doing is supporting sinners. I could see Rabbi Ochanan making that argument because he believes it. But why should anyone else accept that? I mean, if I'm living in Eretz Yisrael, why is Rabbi Ochanan, why does he trump Rav Zalman? But that's what he claimed. Then Rav Zalman said to Rabbi Ochanan, what's the difference between us here and you in Poland? Why should Jerusalem be different than Poland, where the Orthodox sat in the kahilos with the anti-religious elements? And that's when Rabbi Ochanan says what I just told you, that actually he says a little differently. He says, according to the laws in Poland, here in Poland, the Orthodox cannot change the situation. The only way to change it is to say you're not Jewish. But in the Holy Land, well, that's exactly what I said. In the Holy Land, anyone can leave the Vod. I just formulated it a little differently. It's not, actually, you have to join it. So that's the difference. So he says that in Eretz Yisrael, if you don't secede, you are sick. So then, not some others, I think, had said, so why don't you try to change the situation in Poland, make two separate kahilas in Poland, but in Israel it already exists. Then Rav Zalman said to him, if we read it in the Parsha recently, it says that the cry of Sodom was great, and it says God came down to hear it. What does God need to come down to hear it? God can hear it up in the heavens. And the rabbis explain, good Rashi there, that this is a lesson for judges, that when they investigate matters, they actually have to. Be involved. Go see it for themselves. Don't rely. What did Rabbi Ochanan reply? Our sages have said that from results in a nearby case, one may extrapolate to predict what will happen at a distance. Experience has taught us that the existence of a unified Orthodox community in Berlin influenced even the general Kehillah to cater to Orthodox needs. No, sorry, this is. Oh, you say, yeah, sorry. The experience has taught us that the existence of a united Orthodox community in Berlin influenced even the general Kehillah to cater to Orthodox needs such as kashrus and the same in Jerusalem. He's saying that I don't need to be in Eretz Yisrael. No, being in the Vatican, because I see what happened in Germany. The fact that you had a separate Kehillah in Germany, in Berlin, and you also had in Frankfurt, that meant that the general Kehillah, because they were afraid of the Orthodox leaving, they improved the situation for those Orthodox Jews who were in the general Kehillah. So Rav Chanan says, I see, that forget all the other arguments we spoke about being, involved with sinners and everything, that it would help, that if you're not part of the Orthodox community, it would help. The difference, I think, is that in Germany, you always had a majority of Orthodox in the general community and a minority. But Rav Chanan was saying that no Orthodox Jews should be in the Vada Kehillah. Well, if no Orthodox Jews are in the Vada Kehillah, then of course they don't care about kashrus or anything. And then finally, he adds one more point. Yesterday I read that some people banned the periodical Kol Yisrael because it inflames the controversy you talk about between Rav Kook and others. And then he says that even if that's correct, and it should be banned because it increases conflict, there are many secular periodicals. Why don't we ban the secular periodicals as well? To understand this, I have to explain what happened was in Israel. You had all these Kanaim who were attacking Rav Kook. And the rabbis, and these included Rav Zal Meltzer, decided to put them in Cheirim. And the Cheirim was, and they had a newspaper called Kol Yisrael. So Rav Chanan says, well, they're putting the Kanaim in Cheirim. Why don't they put the secular Kanaim in Cheirim also? Well, what good is that going to do? The whole point of the Cheirim was to tell people that these so-called Orthodox Jews are not really in our community, and we're going to shun them. You don't do that to people who are not part of your community. But Artsro gets it wrong. Let me read you what it says here. This is quote, yesterday I read that some people banned the periodical Kol Yisrael because it inflames the controversy. That's a word-for-word translation. Then in brackets, Artsro adds, by printing essays and polemics on both sides. That's not the case at all. Kol Yisrael was the periodical of the extremists, the Neturei Karta Eda Haredit in Jerusalem. The Aguda in Jerusalem, actually. The Aguda in Jerusalem was the Eda Haredit. It had nothing to do with the Aguda in Europe. So Rabbi Chanan was responding to the fact that they placed a ban on the newspaper of the extremists because this newspaper, Kol Yisrael, every week would defame Rav Kook. So I don't know. This was added. The thing I read you in brackets by printing essays and polemics on both sides was added by the English language editors here. Why would a newspaper in Jerusalem, which is run by Kanaim, print both sides? Have you ever heard of such a thing? So that was called. That's the mistake there. Let's go on. The Chazon Ish didn't accept Rabbi Chanan's view about the separate kehilot. And let me read you what the Chazon Ish has to say on this matter. This is in Kovetz. It's a few places you can find this. It's easiest in Rabbi Chanan's Kovetz Ma'amarim. I have to give kudos to the people who put out the Kovetz Ma'amarim. First of all, it's a beautiful edition with notes and everything. They include everything in it. They include the material in opposition to Rav Ochanan. And that's the only honest way to do things, to include both what Rav Ochanan says and what the people opposed him. So what does the Chazon Ish write to Rav Ochanan? He says a few things. Chazon Ish first says exactly what Rav Zalman says. Po ein kan hevdel me'ari pogun. He says there is no difference here in Israel with the Vat HaLaomi than what you have in Poland. We're all in one community. And then he says that we have nothing to do. There's nothing to do with the Vat HaLaomi. Vat HaLaomi is you announce that you're a member of the Vat HaLaomi. You never see the people who run the Vat HaLaomi. You're in a city, let's say you're in Bnei Brak. Everything you see are Torah, our synagogues, and Jews. Once a year, whatever it is, you declare a member of the Vat HaLaomi, but they have no interference. They do nothing. He says, you know who runs Jewish life? He's talking about religious Jewish life, are the rabbis. And there's no one persecuting them. There's no one influencing them. It's all technical. for the sake of taxes and things like that, but there's no involvement whatsoever. So it's just like in Poland. It's Jew, Orthodox Jews are running their own show. So what are they? And furthermore, he says that the problem people we meet, the people who are against religion, they're local people. You have local people in cities, local politicians who are anti-religious. They're the ones we have to struggle with. It's not about Ben Gurion sitting in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv somewhere. And he says the most important thing, and this we have no problem, and everything runs smoothly, are minoi rabbanim, appointing rabbi, shlita, mikveh, shuls, etc. And then he says, as he said, everything depends upon the rabbis, etc., etc. And these rabbis, the mishtadlim, v'halochamim, those rabbis who are fighting against the maharsim, the ones who are trying to destroy Judaism, that is, the local leaders, v'harabanim hatzadikim, the greatest tzadikim in the land of Israel, ain b'knesset. Knesset means the Vatalumi. They are members of the Vatalumi. So then it says, you might think that this sounds like they're giving authority to the chafshim, the irreligious, and they're that the irreligious are joined to the rabbis, etc., etc. That's, on one hand, it might sound, here, the rabbis, the great rabbis, are joined with these heretics, the Vatalumi, but the Chazon Ish says that these rabbis, if they live to be 120 years old, Yecholim linhog rabbanutam, they can live their whole life and have nothing to do with the Vatalumi people. The only thing that matters is what goes on their cities. You have in these cities, what they have a pekid. And they have to get, the pekid has to, approve his position as a rabbi, and that's it. And he says in Poland it's the same thing. You had an Isher Rab in Poland al yedei kehila chafshit. Yeah, in Poland the big cities were majority irreligious, and they also had to approve the appointment of the rabbi. And then he says, "Umei olam lo shamanu chov." We never heard of an obligation in Poland that a Prishat Rav Hagun Meir Shakil Chafshit. We never heard in Poland, and same thing Lithuania, that if it's an irreligious soul, is a majority irreligious city. All the big cities in Poland were majority irreligious in 1934. We never heard that a rabbi could not be a rabbi of a city which was majority irreligious. The other rabbi says, Poland, even the cities, mostly importantly, the cities dominated by the irreligious, we fight to put in a religious rabbi. Think back to Vilna. Did they allow Rabbi Rubinstein to become the rabbi that the Mizrahi wanted? Oh, the Orthodox were not the majority in Vilna. No, they fought to have Rav Chaim Ozer. So that's what the Chazon Ish is saying. He's saying, I don't understand what you're saying, Rabbi Chanan. First of all, there's no significance to this Vatalumi. It's only technical. And the fact that you're going to say that we're somehow, we're joined together with them, so what? That doesn't have any meaning. On the contrary, in Poland and Lithuania, we did that. And rather than run away, we tried to conquer the cities for Torah, so that even if the majority were irreligious, at least the rabbi and the one who made sure of Shlita and Mikveh and the schools and everything was a Torah rabbi. Truth of the matter is, Rabbi Chanan's position makes perfect sense in the context of the Austrian communities in Frankfurt, where they said that even if the larger community really has no involvement with you, the very fact that you're involved with them, the very fact that you pay taxes together with them, that you serve on a committee with them, even if they don't interfere at all in Orthodox life, that was forbidden. But we know in Germany, only four kehillahs were Austrit, and they were always a tiny minority. A tiny minority in Frankfurt and Berlin. In fact, the Ostjuden, those Jews who came from Lithuania and Poland, never joined these Austritzgemeinde, the Gemeinden, the separatist communities. These were only German Jews. When the Jews came, the East European Jews came to Berlin and came to Frankfurt, they always joined the general community, and they didn't even understand the whole Austrit mentality, because how is being in the Frankfurt general community any different than where they were, where irreligious were the majority also? So that's the Chazon Ish's position here. And he has another letter dealing with it as well. I want to give you the response, though. This doesn't end matters. Rabbi Chanan has a response, and then we'll see how, in the end, the Chazon Ish actually agreed that, you know, if people want to do a separate kahila, he's not saying not to do it. And he even supported, you know, some of the people who wanted to do it. But he never agreed with this idea that there's a chiyuv. And then next week, we're going to move into Marienbad. And I'm going to read you some of the protocols of the which survive in one place, only one place that they survive. And we're very lucky that they survive. Protocols of the Agudas Yisrael Convention in Marienbad, Czechoslovakia, where the Agudas Yisrael officially came out in support, over Rabbi Yochanan's objections, officially in support of a state of Israel. What led them to that, why they did it, and why Rabbi Yochanan and two other rabbis, one of whom was Rav Aaron Cutler, were unsuccessful in stopping this move. So we will focus a good part of next class on that, because it's a very important historical event. Let me look at some comments here and questions. We start at the beginning here. Chaim Zeligson-Neminsky, Chazas, we call him. If you know who he was a great, he looked like Rabbi Chanan with the long beard and everything, but he was a maskil and he was a great scientist. Let me take that back. He's not a great scientist in terms of when you think of real scientists, but he was a Jew who knew a lot about science and he was a popularizer of science. So our own Chazas cites a source here that having a non-Jew write something for you on Shabbos, he says you shouldn't allow this to be done. I mean, if you look at Rav Avadia Yosef's tshuva on this in Yabia Omer, in which he explains he wasn't so crazy about it, but they had already been doing it when he arrived in Egypt. He was able to justify it. David says that modern economics support Rabbi Chanan. His Hishtadrut position was protectionist. You get more jobs when you allow cheaper labor. You get more Jewish jobs when you allow cheaper labor to be hired. Hey, this is the old debate that's going on right now with, I mean, the Wall Street Journal believes in open borders. You know, just let them all in because that'll help business because it'll be cheaper. I mean, modern economics also opposes the minimum wage. Modern economics also opposes certain halachic things that, you know, halacha is a bit protectionist. It's not completely free enterprise. If you're a Milton Friedman free enterpriser, you have to assume that when we get a Sanhedrin, they'll revise some of these halachot, which are based on, you would say, lack of understanding of how modern economics work, or you'd say that the modern economy is very different than the tiny economy. Says Rabbi Chanan demonstrated a healthy understanding of economics in a talk they gave during the Depression this year, but we'll get to that. Because Rabbi Chanan wasn't speaking about economics, he was giving the spiritual reasons for these things. When you hear great rabbis speak about, you know, the reasons for the terrorism, you know, that in order to stop the terrorism, we have to do more learning. They're not denying that you need to have guns and protect yourself or anything like that. They're just saying that in addition to the physical causes we can see, there's also spiritual causes. The only exception is Sholem Cohen, the head of the Shas party, who got up in public at the Kotel and said, "We don't need soldiers. God will protect us." But anyone with, you know, any normal person realizes that you need both. You need soldiers, as Rav Mazuz said. Anyone normal, that's what he basically said. Any normal person realizes you need both. You know, you need soldiers and you need Torah learning. Of course, you need both. But you can't have one without the other. Moshe from Lakewood, in his letter to Rabbi Rosenheim, actually, well, again, he's not a rabbi, he's a mister. In next class, we're going to speak about him because of his Yehuda. There he is. You're saying Rabbi Chanan questioned the whole institution idea from the Bolsheviks. Rabbi Chanan wasn't the only one to, you know, many of the rabbis were very troubled by the whole idea of unions. if you want to look at it from a left-wing perspective, what you had is a an unholy alliance between the rabbis and the wealthy. It is true that the wealthy had the ear of the rabbis and had convinced them that these workers were a destabilizing force. And you had plenty of sermons against socialism, and but you also had rabbis who supported what the workers were doing. And you got to give the Pole Agudas Yisrael a lot of credit. They remained in Agudas Yisrael with very little representation among the higher ups. And as I said, they eventually broke. Email me, Moshe. I don't recall. I'm still preparing the Reb Yochanan talks, and I don't remember that letter you mentioned to Rosenheim. So if you can email me exactly where it is, there's other. I know of others who say that exact same thing, but I can't recall anything from Reb Yochanan. So if you know it offhand, email it to me. Okay. So Chaim says that Talmid Chacham goes before an Am Haaretz, to feed him. Yeah, but that's if you have limited resources. If you can only feed, let's say, one. That's how I understand it. The Chazon Ish is saying, though, you have tzedakah, you give to both. You give maybe more to the Talmud Chacham. But it's not that you don't give to them. Not to mention the fact that in practice, those rules in Masechet Horayot have never really been applied. When's the last time, do you think Shaarei Tzedek Hospital determines that men go before women? The answer is because even from a halachic perspective, later on they say, Mamzer Talmud Chacham goes first. What it's showing is that everyone is an individual, and if you, in theory, if you have a man who's the exact equal in every way with a woman, the man will go first. But how do we know? The woman is could be a greater Torah scholar or have more mitzvos. So that those are mostly theoretical. Moshe says, Reb Chaim Moser writes in a letter concerning Auschwitz that it's not Torah halacha, it cannot be decided by Das Torah. Every situation is different and must be assessed on an individual basis. That is correct. That's in 1913, I think it was, they wrote to Reb Chaim Moser about this. Even though this matter was going on in Germany for many years, and Reb Chaim Moser said that when this dispute broke out in Germany between Hirsch and Reb Zalman Ber Bamberger, there's a reason why they never asked the Gedolim of Eastern Europe. They never asked Rav Yitzchok Hanan Spector, the Netziv, and they always would ask them questions on halacha. And that's because this isn't a halachic question. It can't be decided like you decide other matters in Shas and Poskim, that this has to do with Hashkafa Nechona. That's the words he used. How you evaluate the situation. The opponents of Auschwitz thought that you'd help the Jewish community more by being involved, and the supporters thought just the opposite. So it's not a, he says, you can't decide this based on Klalei Halacha. Those are the words he used. And that was Rav Chaim Moser's position about all these matters, about not just about Auschwitz, about Avodah Ivrit, about the state as well. We spoke in the Rav Chaim Moser classes how his position dealing with should they support a Jewish state. That is an amazing letter that Moshe mentions, not only because of what Rav Chaim Moser says, but because he refuses to rule. Here, he's the Gadol Hador, the greatest sage of generation, and he's asked the question. And he says, I can't answer it because who am I? I'm not on the spot. You have to ask the local rabbis. Can you imagine today if you went to one of the great rabbis and you gave them the question, if they would say, yeah, and they have a chance to have great influence, say, no, I'm not going to. I mean, it shows where you find Rav Chaim Moser's greatness is not just in his answers, but also when he doesn't give an answer. And the fact that he says, this is not something for me or anyone else to answer, it shows such insight. And then, as we said, he says it's not even a halacha question per se. It deals with what you think is best for the Jewish community. Those who want to see that letter, it's in the collected writings of Rav Chaim Moser, but I don't think that's on HebrewBooks.org. You can find it also in the Sefer Zikaron for Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. And I should remind everyone that, because I was reminded at my talk in Edison on Saturday night, that coming up in a couple months, is the 50th anniversary of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg's Yahrzeit. So I hope things will be done about that. There will be stuff in Jerusalem, but not the sort of stuff that maybe will please me so much, because at the 40th anniversary of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg's passing, they had a whole gathering on a Motzei Shabbos where they had all sorts of speakers, and I have the booklet they published, speakers with Strimals and other things, and one of the speakers was Strimals. Actually, no, it was a different speaker, but also from that community goes off on how this person wrote a dissertation at Harvard, and he completely distorts Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. So I don't want to be a subject of an attack again. What he argues is that, yes, Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, all these things he did, but he only did it because as a means of kiruv, because the West European Jews, he needed to reach them. And therefore, his whole life and all his tshuvos and everything, all his stuff he wrote was only in order to keep them in the Orthodox world, but not that he himself ever had any sympathy or any connection to that world. It's the exact same thing they say about Rav Soloveitchik. He didn't go to Berlin to go to the university. He went to Berlin to escape the draft or this and that. Okay, but I hope they do something on the 50th anniversary. Chaim said, no. Moshe, nowhere does anyone say that you can assent and they are guilty. No, but what he's referring to, what Chazas is referring to, he's not referring to killing anyone. He's referring to, if that's what you're talking about, Moshe, he's referring to not at, and taking an action to save them. But we're not talking about killing anyone. Chaim says that Reb Reuven Grozovsky takes the argument of being together with the origins and his Bayot HaZman very seriously. You don't need Reb Reuven Grozovsky. You have Reb Chanan, but you have this is the whole German Orthodox Auschwitz position and the Hungarian position. The Hungarians all assume that it was absolutely forbidden to be involved with them, even if you had the complete rights to do what you wanted to do. Even if you weren't affected, you couldn't be involved with them. So that's a great dispute. What we have to stress, though, and this is what the Chazon Ish mentions, is that this was not the practice in Poland, and this was not the practice in Lithuania, and the Nitziv, in that famous response of his, when the Machziki Hadas organization in Galicia wanted to bring Auschwitz to Eastern Europe, the Nitziv in his tshuva says that this idea is like putting a dagger in our hearts. That is, when we fight among ourselves, but when we deal with the non-Jews and we go to the non-Jews, we go as unified, as one Jewish community. So that you have a dispute here between the certain rabbis in Germany and pretty much all rabbis in Hungary, and the rabbinic position in Poland and Lithuania. In Poland and Lithuania, they were actually opposed to Auschwitz because that would mean giving up, their right. The whole claim of the traditional Jews in Lithuania and Poland was that this is a Torah community. Right now, we might not be the majority, but this is Brisk and Vilna. I mean, this is we are the guardians of the Torah community. To form a separate community means giving up everything to the irreligious, and they didn't want to do that. They wanted to conquer it. And what's it like in Eretz Yisrael? Eretz Yisrael follows the model of Poland and Lithuania. The Haredim are all with. I'm not talking about the Ada Haredi types, which just really have in Jerusalem. They all are involved, and especially now with Rebbe Yosef. Not only are they involved in it, they want to conquer it. Who are all the Dayanim? They all are these Haredim and everything. This idea that you'd be separate, on the contrary, the Haredi viewpoint in Eretz Yisrael is the exact same viewpoint it was in Poland and Lithuania. We not to separate yourself. On the contrary, be part of the general community. Be in the Bate Din and conquer it. For Torah, for your version of religiosity. Believe me, the religious Zionists would be very happy if the Haredim decided to be Auschwitz people, like the Ada Haredi. They would, it would be, all the Bate Din will be dominated by the modern Orthodox, the religious Zionists. You wouldn't have any of these inter-Orthodox fighting. And if you ask yourself, where do they get this idea from? Because what happens today in the land of Israel is exactly what was going on in Poland and Lithuania, where it was thought to be foolish to separate. For a variety of reasons, for economic reasons, this and that. How does it affect me if I'm a religious Jew and I'm in the general community? And what you have today in Israel is a direct continuation of the Vat HaLomi. Yisrael, who's now in Beit Shemesh, I didn't realize that. Mazal Tov on that Aliyah. The Ger Rebbe also told Rav Schwab. Okay, very nice. Chazas, we'll stay on for 5 more minutes. Chazas tells us that American newspapers ridiculed claims by Stalin that Solzhenitsyn had anticipated Americans in the development of the telegraph, but his grandson was able to confirm some of Stalin's claims. Okay, I mean, as far as I know, Chazas never actually was in a laboratory. and did experiments and did everything. As far as I know, everything he knew came from books, so you can't really call him a scientist. Shlomo says, "How come Rav Chaim Ozer weighed in on the Berlin Seminary?" Ah, because going to the land of Israel was different. Israel, Eretz Yisrael, was a traditionalist society. Rav Chaim Ozer thought that the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary was great in Berlin. In Berlin, and not just in Berlin, in Western Europe, it would be great anywhere in Western Europe. However, in Eastern Europe, he might have even agreed that in places of Eastern Europe it would be good. But in a traditional society like Eretz Yisrael, where they know nothing, where people are not getting secular educations, where they're not going to university, to bring this model of a rabbi, which he says it explicitly, to bring the model of the rabbi doctor, that would destroy striving for Torah, would destroy the model of a Torah society. And that's why he opposed it in the land of Israel.